title is Why Tony Benn Should Be a Socialist. To me, it's a wee bit of a crazy title. But nevertheless, the reason it was decided to take this one is apparently Tony Benn spoke here on why you should be a socialist. What I intend to show very briefly, because I'd rather have questions and points of view and discussion rather than me rabbiting on, is what I intend to show, first of all, the most important item as far as the Socialist Party of Great Britain is concerned, namely what socialism is. Secondly, to try and point out or illustrate, at least get you thinking about the subject that we hold, namely that the Labour Party is not a socialist party and never has been a socialist party, or never will be one. Thirdly, to show that the individual concerned, although not really all that concerned about him as an individual, is not a socialist and is in fact a supporter of the buying and selling system. And last of all, of course, most important of all, from the standpoint of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, how to get socialism. So first of all, what socialism is. This morning, along with a comrade of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, I had a look at the university bookshop across the road, and I wasn't astounded, amazed, astonished to find that there was umpteen pamphlets and periodicals all claiming to be socialist. I would have found the same and have found the same any time I spoke in Liverpool or Manchester or Glasgow or Edinburgh or anywhere else in the British Isles. And no doubt if I was privileged enough to manage to get the cash together and go and speak in America or anywhere in the continent, I would find the same thing. There's a tremendous multiplicity of claims of what socialism is. So I'd like to get that one out of the way first of all. The Socialist Party start in the sort of ABC of their case by defining what we mean by capitalism. What we mean is something very specific and definite. We mean a social system, as it happens, a worldwide social system, based on commodity production, the wage labour. No matter what the claims may be made in various parts of the globe, in the USSR, or in the Republic of China, or Castro's Cuba, or elsewhere about having socialism, or something different from capitalism, we see that capitalism can always be understood by the fact that all wealth takes the form of commodities, that is, articles produced for sale on a market with a view to making a profit. And no matter where you look in the world, you will find that everything's produced for sale. You've got production for sale, production for profit. And that's as true as the USSR as it is of the USA. The modern capitalism stretches from the North Pole to the South Pole, from the Rockies to Siberia. It's a worldwide social system. And you can always tell it by the fact that everything's produced for sale. That it's a class society where we've got a group of people who own all the means of producing and distributing wealth. That is the factories and the workshops, the mines, commercial undertakings. And another group of people, the large majority, who basically own nothing but their ability to work. And in order to live, I've got to work for a wage, a salary, or a commission. That class division is peculiar to modern capitalism and exists all over the world. We say further, because we've got a society based on production for profit, you inevitably have the problems of war and of poverty and of crime and all the other social problems. We claim that there is no way you can run this buying and selling system that would in any way alter those problems. That war is inevitable, that poverty is inevitable, while you have a buying and selling, profit-producing society. So that when we talk about socialism, we mean a complete transformation of that. We do not mean nationalisation, nor do we mean some form of state control, or a very strong central government, or the state owning everything. What we mean basically is a new society wherein the whole earth, the whole planet, everything in it and on it, all the means of producing and distributing wealth, will be owned in common with the whole world's population. We mean of a society without buying are selling. We mean a society without ownership. The whole concept of private ownership is completely foreign to the Socialist Party of Great Britain's viewpoint of world socialism. Just as today we would think it would be insane to sell the air we breathe, and that you would not be allowed to breathe it unless you had a certain amount of a means of exchange in your pocket, so inside a socialist society it would be impossible to sell food, clothing, shelter, entertainment or information. Everything inside a socialist society would be produced solely for use. It is fundamentally a society for production solely for use. A society with no classes, because classes are economic groups who have an interest opposed to another economic group. Inside a socialist society, we envisage no countries and no borders. Now that very briefly, and I've no doubt I've got a lot of disagreement on that, but I don't want to labour the point. I'll leave that to you, and I'm quite sure that those who disagree or misunderstand or both will take me to task on it. On to the second part about the Labour Party not being a socialist party. We would claim that the history of the Labour Party, and again, rather than illustrate this at this point, we'll deal with it in questions or discussion. But enough and suffice at the moment for us to state this, our view on it, that the Labour Party are not in favour of the abolition of the buying and selling system. We could take any election address of the British Labour Party and find in effect that what they were after was to reform the present social system. They would claim they wanted more jobs, or they wanted to do something about the plight of their aged, or they wanted to do something about education programmes, or they wanted to do something about the health service. But you can search their election address from top to bottom, there will be nothing in it about abolishing the basic cause of the problems, that is international capitalism. And of course, it's not just a theoretical question here, because we have had Labour governments, and we have found when we had Labour governments, they've supported wars, they've supported peacetime conscription, they've supported the nuclear programme, the nuclear armaments, the British owning class. They have used troops against strikers. They've introduced wage freezes, pay pauses, and all the rest of it. In other words, they've done everything that the Conservative, the modern Conservative Party have done, and they've done everything that the old Liberal Party done in power. They have behaved exactly the way they are, namely a political party that wants to run British capitalism. And in more honest days, they had their leaders, Mr. Gaitskell, who would boldly state, as he did in the Manchester Guardian, that the Labour Party stands to run capitalism a little more fairly than the Conservative Party. That's the viewpoint. And it's no miracle that that's the case, because, as I say, if you look at their election address or their history, that is what they've always done. But another thing that they've always done, of course, is they've always had wild men on the left. In fact, to look at the British Labour Party and to look at the careers of the great men in the Labour Party, the Bevans, the Gaitskells, the Wilsons and so on, is like reading a piece of English prose. It reads from left to right. The wild man becomes a statesman. That happens all the time. None of the present wild men are liable to be anything different. Because basically, the Labour Party is an opportunist, reformist political party that wishes to gain power, and gain power any way they can. And the individual that this happens to be dealing with, Mr. Wedgwood Benn, or Tony Wedgwood Benn, is likewise, as a loyal supporter of the Labour Party, he must be tarred with the same brush. Namely, he is a supporter of the buying and selling system. Then the Socialist Standard in January this year, there was an interview with Mr. Benn, in which they dealt with one of his books, called Arguments for Socialism, and a couple of socialists here asked him several questions. And there's absolutely no doubt about it. He talks about socialism will have investment. He even goes so far as to say, I've never heard the argument used that socialism would abolish the concept of investment. Well, that's unfortunate, because socialism means the end of investment, the end of profit, the end of wages, and the end of prices. And it's not just a case here of having a contrary view to the Socialist Party of Great Britain. It's an extremely confused one. For instance, when asked about the record of the Labour Party, he could say this. In 1959, the Labour Party was persuaded to abandon socialism on the basis that capitalism would always give you growth, welfare, full employment, and so on. There's a lot of confusion here about just exactly what he means by the term socialism. Not that he's unique in that respect, of course. The Daily Express under Beaverbrook's son during an election time would always talk about the Labour Party as being a socialist party, to such an extent they would even distort the TV programmes or the radio programmes and change a party political broadcast on behalf of the Labour Party. They used to always change it to the Socialist Party. And the Socialist Party of Great Britain, I don't know how often, would take them to the press council to try and get them to correct this. But of course, it never worked. It's rather like going to the Police Federation and complaining about how the police behaved in Glasgow one Saturday night. Rather pointless. In fact, I think the Socialist Party gave up the whole exercise after a couple of years at it. Now, that idea, socialism, from time to time in certain areas, under certain conditions, members of the Labour Party will claim that they are socialists. And, you know, they'll say certain words that would lead to you believe to think it's something to do with socialism. But in real practical terms, they're absolutely opposed to the concept of world socialism. Now, from our viewpoint, by far the most important thing for members of the working class to get to grips with is this how to get socialism. Because basically, of course, that's where the Labour Party and the Communist Party and all these other organisations are completely out of step with us, or our opponents would say we're out of step with them. Namely, they believe that a group of very clever men, dedicated men, extremely smart, can get to power inside British capitalism or some other country's capitalism, and by a series of very cunning legislation, gradually get rid of capitalism. In fact, he used to use the term. Keir Hardie, so beloved of the Labour Party, used to use the term that socialism will come like a thief in the night. Well, the Labour Party was formed in 1906, and it's been a very long, cold, wintry night, because we're no more near it now by their efforts than they were when we were formed in 1906. We place all our emphasis on this one proposition. Socialism means the common ownership and democratic control of all the world's resources by all the world's people. That's what it means. And because of the nature of a socialist society, namely it's democratic and it's based on common ownership, what is needed to bring it about is majority understanding. The Socialist Party of Great Britain are absolutely opposed to the concept of leadership, whether it be a Hitler, a Stalin, a Wilson, a Foote, a Gaitskell, a Thatcher, or whatever. All of these people are what are called political leaders, and there is only a need for a leader when you have people who don't know where they're going. To give you a very simple illustration, on a Saturday evening, if you had to be preparing yourself to go out to go for a drink, you would take it rather harsh if I appeared in the scene and said, oh, this is your Saturday night, This is your night out. Right, good. Follow me. You'll drink the following. Drambuie and Guinness. You'll do this. You'll do that. You'll play these records. You think it rather strange that I should attempt to tell you what to do with your leisure. If we happen to go to a dance hall and we had to get in Glasgow what we call a lumber, that is, if we hit it off and get a young lady to go home with us, you'd look upon it rather strange if some individual who turned all on all that charm had to take the lady to her back gate, or in Glasgow the back close, and then say, just a moment, my darling, and walk out in the street and say, my friend, I wonder if you would do a loving for me. You'd think that insane. In fact, you'd be a bit of a pervert if you ever engaged in anything like that. So you wouldn't let someone do your drinking for you. You wouldn't let someone do your loving for you. But this concept that the working class have got, a slavish one, that you're going to let someone else do your thinking for you, is a thing that's exploited by politicians of every hue throughout the political spectrum. This concept of leadership is the absolute opposite to the concept of a society based on common ownership and democratic control. It's not a question here of the Socialist Party of Great Britain being ultra-democratic because we're nice guys and nice gals. It's not a question of that. It's because the nature of the society determines the way you get it. You cannot bring about a society based on common ownership and democratic control if you go along with this concept of leadership. The old Bolshevik Party used to talk about the ends justifying the means. That this beautiful goal they had, well, because it was such a beautiful goal, then of course they were allowed to rob, to cheat, to imprison, to torture, to maim, and to kill. That was the viewpoint of the Lenins, the Stalins, the Trotskyists, right through up till present day. That anything justified this wonderful goal that you're getting. But we look at it the other way. It's not a question here of the end justifying the means. The end determines the means. If you're going to have a workable society based on common ownership and democratic control, the organisation seeking that, in turn, must be a democratic political party. And that is why, since it was formed in 1904, the Socialist Party of Great Britain never has had a leader. The Socialist Party of Great Britain has never had secret meetings. Every meeting of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, from a local branch meeting to a meeting of the executive committee, is open to the public. Because the nature of socialism determines that we must act in a democratic fashion. Now, to the critic of the Socialist Party, such as Mr. Benn, who calls us purists, something that the Labour Party could never be accused of, who calls us impossibilists and tells us that we should adopt a practical policy. Well, the Labour Party have been adopting this practical policy since the formation in 1906. The wars have not lessened, they have got worse. The gap between rich and poor has not lessened. Relatively, it's got greater in relation to the wealth that is now produced. And all the social problems that they set out to deal with, such as crime, are a much lot worse. For instance, even the most nightmare Labour Party in 1906 could never have dreamt of this morning's Guardian, where they are putting forward this view that what would happen in the event of a limited nuclear war. And the quote at the Royal Society of Medicine, this group called the Medical Association for the Prevention of War, a guy called Professor P.J. Lindrop of Barts Hospital here in London, he goes on to project what would happen in the event of a nuclear warhead striking one of these places like Windscale or something like that. And he said, after it, the conference, composed of doctors, the conference unanimously endorsed the view that organised medical intervention, bringing medical assistance to those in urgent need, will not be possible in nuclear war, as there was no effective civil defence. Now, that's the kind of nightmare world that's brought about by what the Labour Party would call practical policies, the Something Now Brigade. There is no way that these problems are going to lessen as long as the members of the working class leave their thinking and their action up to people who are committed to protecting the buying and selling system. So this afternoon we ask you to consider a revolutionary proposition that we have a new society based in common ownership. That's not the conclusion, of course, unfortunately, of this wrongly called organisation, the Medical Association for the Prevention of War, because it says here in conclusion in this article that Professor Michael Letcher of the Disaster Epidemiology Centre at Louvain, Belgium, called on the conference to seek a new ethical view by the medical profession and its attitude to weapons of mass destruction. Well, ethics or morals do not enter into it. The reason that armies cross borders, the reason that nuclear warheads are released, is because we live in a competitive world where the American capitalist class are in conflict with the Russian, the British, the German, and all the other capitalist classes, that this conflict over markets and trade routes and military bases, despite all the ethical humbug that's put out by the doctors here or the priests or the pastors, that the reality of the situation, the practical consideration here, is world markets, trade routes, and military bases. And that was so much recognised that way back in the last century, that it was well known, nobody ever kidded anybody on, that the job of the Minister of War was anything other than to protect the British capitalist class interests abroad. The reason that armies cross borders is to protect private property owned by a certain group against another certain group. And the awful tragedy of it, of course, and all the wars up to date, the next one may be a little different, of course, is that it's the working class who are the major victims of these conflicts. And at the end, at the cessation of hostilities, then, of course, once again, they have lost the war. The British working class in 1945, far from finding themselves the victors, having had to undertake such things as being bombed in their towns in London or Coventry or Glasgow or Clydebank. Some of them found, especially in the area of the world I come from, in the Glasgow and Clydebank area, having been bombed, they found that later on in late 50s, early 60s, in order to get a job in the shipyards, they had to go over to Germany. Because this is the thing about capitalism. It doesn't worry about national boundaries. Wherever there's a profit to be made, wherever it's possible to get surplus value from the working class, then they will cross it with their investments. So we would ask you, as I say this afternoon, to consider the case for world socialism as put forward by the Socialist Party of Great Britain and our companion parties in the United States of America, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and in Austria and Ireland. We'd ask you to consider the revolutionary proposition. But to the charge that perhaps we are being, as Mr. Foote accused us of being religious, pure, evangelical, and not being practical, we would say that the case for socialism is in line with the way society is developing. In other words, it's not only the voice of the Socialist Party of Great Britain and its companion parties, rather like a voice in the wilderness crying out here, that there are other things that are leading people to socialist ideas. That is the very development of capitalism itself. Some of the great enemies of the socialist case, because the Socialist Party is a relatively old political party, formed as it was in the beginning of this century, 1904, some of our great enemies have disappeared. One of the major ones, for instance, was the religious bigotry of the working class. Well aware, of course, that that still exists, that the Pope at Easter gets up and speaks outdoors, he's greeted with something like 250,000 people. He's not greeted by a handful of people as I am this afternoon. But nevertheless, that tremendous sway of religious superstition is failing. And it's not failing because of the efforts of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. Oh, that it were. It's failing because of the development of capitalism itself. Likewise, the attitude towards authority and authorities as being the holder of all knowledge, to a very large extent, finds itself disappearing. The politicians can no longer come along at wartime or other crisis period and say, well, we want you to die for your king and your country. You'll have to think up something a little more subtle than that. Your way of life, perhaps, something of that nonsensical stature. But nevertheless, the changes inside capitalism are acting towards a growing socialist knowledge on behalf of the working class. We would say further that the great technological advances of the last 20 years, that there is only one society that can encompass that, that this tremendous step forward in electronics, there's basically only one society that can embrace these new ideas. Short of being Luddites and trying to hold back developments, and we're well aware of the working class are far from being progressive in this fashion, that trade unions, because they are basically defensive mechanisms and certainly not revolutionary, have fought against the development, technical developments. That in the newspaper industry for now, they're in a great battle for their very livelihood to stop technical advances in modern society. But nevertheless, by the nature of capitalist society, these will come about. They will come about because in a drive for profit, they're the only way to have them. But of course, it'll become more and more apparent then that that amazing amount of wealth that modern capitalism's capable of producing is being destroyed and people are going without. In the local newspaper on Sunday, before coming away from here, a rag of a newspaper called the Sunday Mail, they were up in arms about the fact, because of EEC agreements, in Peterhead in Aberdeen, the fishermen were sending the fish back out and throwing them back into the sea, at the same time as a third of the world's population starves. Capitalism used to be a progressive step forward. It broke away all the old fetters of production that feudalism had. But now, by its very development, it's now in a restrictive period where it stops innovation, where it stops progress, where it stops the creation of new means of production, and also where it has this tremendous contrast between people who are going without things and at the same time wealth being destroyed. So we would ask you to very seriously consider the proposition that the Socialist Party of Great Britain puts forward. We're not so interested in Tony Benn becoming a socialist. We're more concerned about you becoming a socialist. And of course, there's nothing I can say or do, really, that'll make you a socialist. You don't convert people to socialism. That's a process that goes on in your own head. You've got to figure it out. You've got to work for it. You've got to look at the arguments and decide whether they're valid or invalid. That's the only way to be convinced and become a conscious socialist. And we would ask you, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I've tried to be as brief as possible. I hope I've not went on too long, and I hope I've got a lot of questions. We would ask you what this social system, with its wars and threats of wars, with its poverty, with its racial and religious bigotry, has ever done for you, that you should continue supporting this social system. We ask you to seriously consider the case for a new world, world socialism. Thank you.